Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this past week's shows. On Wednesday, July 24th, Joe was joined by UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, Siena College professor of comparative politics Vera Icarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Robert Griffin, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
I would like to start this morning by something that happened shortly after we left the program yesterday, and that is the resignation of the Secret Service director. Kimberly Cheadle faced scrutiny after the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump at a rally. On Monday, there was a congressional hearing, and in a great show of bipartisanship, both Republican and Democratic members of the committee looked at her and said, "What?" Well, what are you talking about? And so eventually there was a lot of pressure, obviously, on her to resign. The final report from the committee said that she should resign. And yesterday, indeed, she decided that she would actually resign. So that brings us to what happened, and still a lot of questions about the assassination attempt itself. And Kimberly Cheadle resigned. In light of recent events, it is with a heavy heart that I have made the difficult decision to step down as your director, Cheadle wrote in a letter to staff, saying she took full responsibility for the failure. The incident does not define us, Cheadle told the staff. I do not want my calls for resignation to be a distraction from the great work each and every one of you do towards our vital mission. The attack, in which a gunman opened fire with an AR-style rifle from an unsecured roof at a Trump presidential campaign rally July 13th, was the first against a U.S. leader on the elite protective agency's watch in more than 40 years. Cheadle, a veteran Secret Service agent, had called the security failure unacceptable and acknowledged that the buck stops with me. Took her a little while to figure that out or to come to that immediate conclusion. However, just everything, more and more information started to mount that was negative toward the agency. And Bob, I guess the easiest way to say this is that, I mean, obviously it's a significant failure if the person that you are set to, your entire job is to protect that person, and that person gets struck by a bullet, that would definitely be a failure.
It was definitely a failure. Her presentation was, talking to Judy about professors at the table. If my first year gave a presentation like that, I would be pulling him aside saying, you obviously did not prepare for this class, so go back and do it again. I'm glad I'm going first, because there's nothing good to say about what happened yesterday. I mean, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed for her. I was embarrassed for the organization. I don't know how she wasn't prepared. I mean, anybody with a lick of common sense could have came up with the top 10 questions that were going to be asked. And she did something, you know, that we don't see much. She basically created a bipartisan answer to a problem, and the problem was her. I was shocked at the lack of quality. I was shocked at the lack of answers. I think it was really embarrassing. Mm-hmm. What's really clear, though, to me, Joe, is that there is, while the end result was a catastrophic failure, there are multiple failure points in what occurred at that event that's going to require a total review and rewrite of protocols, because the system didn't work in multiple different ways. So it wasn't just one element of failure. Mm-hmm. It was multiple. Mm-hmm. And she should have gone. She absolutely should have gone.
Well, let me just ask you a quick question, then I want to go to Vera. But
sure.
One of the arguments, and I never found it to be a strong argument, but one of the arguments was, as we're investigating this, and as we're trying to figure out what the systemic problems are, that it is helpful to then have the person who is responsible for those failures to at least be in the room. But, I mean, my problem with that is, okay, but you still have, like, tomorrow's event, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and if the failures are the failures, then will those failures continue? But how do you move on a dime in an agency like this when there's so much at stake?
So what they'll do is that they'll be hyper-attentive, almost to the point of going too far the other way, being restrictive. They came out with a request yesterday that I read about, asking for just interior events, no outside events, which are harder to guide, to plan for, and so they're already putting changes in place. I would imagine for any of the events for either Harris or Trump. Going forward, if you're planning to attend, plan to go even earlier than you did before, because it's going to take a lot longer to get in. So mm-hmm. there will be a lot of heightened security. The issue, though, you know, I think what bothers me is I don't disagree with what you said about, you know, you want the person in the room to help make the changes, but there was nothing in her presentation that pointed me to her bringing any value added. And I'll stop and turn it over to the other panelists.
Yeah. So I was thinking, you know, I only listened to parts of the hearing because it was so ridiculous. I just couldn't take it anymore. She was obfuscating. She was non-transparent. She had no answers. It was quite shocking, actually, for somebody who was in a leadership position. So I wonder. So there are two trains of thoughts that I have on this. Either she got really poor advice on how to deal with a congressional hearing, and she was told, don't disclose anything, just say it's under investigation, you know, some lawyerly sort of tactic. Or there's something that's hidden that she didn't want to open some doors, and there are some really serious fundamental problems within the Secret Service that she didn't want to address at all. And we know that the Secret Service has had a history during the Obama era already. They had Secret Service agents flying into Colombia and having sexual relations with prostitutes and other women. And they were the front people, the front team, and they didn't secure Obama's arrival. They had a fun party and got totally drunk. Mm-hmm. So there might be some issues within the Secret Service that she was trying not to disclose, and this sort of lawyering in front of Capitol Hill. It was shocking.
Would that have made a difference if it was a closed hearing as opposed to an open hearing?
Yeah, Vera, you're right. I would note, though, that nothing looks like conspiracy quite like incompetence. If there was something that was getting into anything that would affect security, she could have simply said, this is something that we really need to talk to you about, but I would ask that we go into, you know, a classified hearing.
Right. Which she didn't even do.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is the opportunity to say it, but she didn't even give the agency that option.
Yeah.
There was some reporting that she had planned to resign, but not until after the Democratic National Convention, but yesterday's hearing or the day before hearing made that impossible. This information vacuum exacerbates the conspiracy theories out there, and they are rampant about this mm-hmm. shooting. Coming forth with real information would have done at least something to tamp down those incredibly destructive conspiracy theories.
I mean, if you have nothing to say that's meaningful, then quit before you have to say it, right?
Yeah. Right. She had been subpoenaed. And then the FBI director's before the Oversight Committee, I think, today. So maybe we'll get clearer information from him. Again, this seems like some basic information that certainly should have been conveyed to the public in that hearing and wasn't.
And also to dump everything on the local police. That was shocking in the beginning as a strategy, and then to sort of mislead about the slope of the roof. I mean, she didn't even have basic information that we now know from reporters.
I mean, they're still overseeing the entire operation, and even if the local police or local law enforcement isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing, which I'm not saying
they weren't, right?
But were they ever directed properly? And that's the other question. Right. Jennifer Burns.
Okay, so the first thing, as I was reading through many articles about this, that I noticed is the consistent mentioning of being underfunded and understaffed in the Secret Service. And I don't know a lot about the allocation of money and how that is determined and what training goes into preparing people for the Secret Service. So I thought that was really interesting. And then also the pushback one of the criticisms of Cheadle was that she was hiring more women, or that she had a focus on hiring more women. And it was sort of just like dropped there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't quite know what to make of it. Like, if that it was a criticism clearly of her, and like another way to say that she was single-minded and really kind of just looking in sort of the anti-DEI attacks that are going on right now. And then the other thing, which I had brought up before we went on the air, was that I found it really interesting that many of the women in leadership positions that are now going before the House committees there seems to be a pattern where they're either advised, and it's a systemic problem, where they're advised to perform this way, or they're given misguided direction on how to respond, or they're not prepared. Almost like a bit of a weird sexist training that this should be the way to address this questioning at that sort of level. And I don't know where to go with that yet.
So but why would you do it
then,
though?
There just seems to be a sense across the board. What do you mean?
Meaning if you're trained that way and it still doesn't seem to be the right thing to do, why would you do it?
I don't know. I think that when you're starting to see more and more women in some of these upper-level positions, and some of the mentors or advisees may have some microaggressions that they're not familiar with, it's not as if they're all in the same room getting advice from the same people. It could be the some of the preparation of the people who are advising them or giving them advice.
And this
that's off.
And this is not in any way getting her off the hook.
Absolutely not. I mean, it could also be women who are advising her to just be quiet, you know, say little as you can as a protection mechanism. But it could also be men who are saying, you know, your lawyers or others will handle this. And this is the proper way to seem strong and stoic and protect yourself. So you don't really know, but it just seems like a common pattern for many of these women.
So the pattern you're referring to were some of the college
university presidents who were brought before the House committee. Yeah,
and like it's sort of some patterns
similar,
like that too.
Yeah, like speaking points. Yeah. And in this case with Cheadle, not speaking points, but where they are, I don't want to say they're projecting or deflecting, but they just seem misleading, and it makes them look like they're being led rather than they're leading in their positions. Mm-hmm. And that someone else, they're speaking the words of someone else rather than their own thoughts and training.
They seem inauthentic. Right?
Bob?
Yeah, the preparation, I mean, unless it's changed since I was there, I mean, there's a team that will prepare you, and we would go through something that we would call a murder board, where there would be people playing the roles of the individuals on Congress who would grill you to try to stress test your answers. So the idea that you were prepared differently, I don't think so. I don't think that's the case. Now, what I don't know or what constraints were put on her to say, you know, listen, you're going to take a bullet for us anyway. So these are things we don't want you to say. And that was always, I always found that really difficult, because the way I would have answered a question versus the way I was instructed to in order to follow the policy line of the administration were sometimes two very different things.
But regardless, you would think you would have some answer for.
Yes.
Why did you let him walk around with a scope?
Well, that and the timeline. I mean, again, I think we said on break, she could have just read one of the articles from one of the major newspapers and given more information than she did there. The excuse about not having enough resources, I'm sorry, that's garbage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every agency is always complaining about lack of resources. There is plenty of money in DHS to put resources into its core mission, and including especially the Secret Service. So I thought that was disingenuous. The training they get is exceptional. It is a well-trained organization.
So I have a question, though, for you on the budget issue, because I recall seeing some data that the Secret Service gets half the annual amount of New York City's police department.
Okay.
And they have a lot more people to protect now because the families are enlarging, and we have, you know, the entire Trump clan gets protection. The Obamas, prior presidents, the children, right. The Bidens. So it seems like a lot of people in this more violent-prone environment need protection, get protection, including federal judges. And so maybe that needs to be revisited in terms of what their key mission is in terms of protection, and if there's another agency they can do other types of protections, or if they need a bigger budget.
So
She was asked if she had a resources for the issue, and she said no. And she was asked if the department was under stress and didn't have the resources they needed because of the NATO summit that had just happened mm-hmm. and had used a lot of time. And she said no. She was asked if she needed congressional representatives said to her, if you needed more money, you could have come to us and asked for it. And she said, I didn't need more money.
To clarify, the Secret Service doesn't protect the judges. Okay.
Oh, okay.
It's the U.S. Marshals.
Oh, U.S.
Okay.
Marshals.
So,
okay.
So
thank
one
you
of the
that.
Things that this gets into the weird bureaucracy, but like the court system has its own security details. Okay. The Department of Defense has its own security details. The Secret Service has. Yes, a large portfolio, but there are other people doing other things. And Congress has its own security, and right. I understand the reason is that Congress doesn't want to be beholden on the executive branch for their security. Mm-hmm. So you see the balance of power come to mm-hmm. Everything, including security. But the issue of resources. If the Secret Service doesn't have enough resources, the first place they go is the secretary, and the secretary will move money. I mean, mm-hmm. I ran the research and development arm of the department. We were one of the first places that they would go to raid if one of the primary mission spaces didn't have, you know, if the Coast Guard didn't have something or the Secret Service didn't have something. I mean, there is huge opportunity to move money. So I agree with you. I don't think it's a okay. resource issue. It was a failure of imagination. It was a failure of protocol. It was a failure of thinking broadly enough about what the threat vectors are.
So I'm so glad you're on to explain all this to us. So if it's not money, and if it's not training, as you say, I would say then it must be communication or leadership style. And, you know, when I look at communication, I mean things like where agencies don't really communicate well, like where the sheriff's office did not really meet extensively or speak with responsible agents, or agents didn't reach out enough, or there's something going on where the flow of information was disrupted. And that goes back to leadership style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not welcoming the flow of information in the broadest way, then new leadership has to come. I mean, we saw her performance was pathetic, obviously, in this hearing. But in general, then I would say the blame is to be placed on some kind of obstruction within the bureaucracy and the ability to communicate not just hierarchically up, but across agencies or across different units.
Vera Carius-Kelly on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, July 24th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, July 25th, Joe Donahue was once again joined by Judy Patrick, this time also with public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, and theater artist, arts advocate, activist, and executive director for Project SAGE in Lakeville, Connecticut, Kristen Vangenhoven.
President Biden looked to define his legacy in an address explaining his campaign exit last night. Several days after, it was Sunday that the announcement was made that he was leaving, and it was Wednesday night in which he spoke to the nation. In that period of time, a lot has happened, especially with the Kamala Harris campaign for president. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on, too, of what those 48 hours post-announcement were like in that campaign. Some, I think, good reporting on that. Meanwhile, even with the spotlight now on Vice President Harris as Democrats' likely presidential nominee, President Biden sought to show how he'll be engaged until his term ends, delivering a somber, reflective address from the Oval Office, flanked by family. We should note, I believe they said there were 41 people in the room in the Oval Office. Well, I think they violated fire code, but we don't want to get into that. Anyway, they were extolling democracy and decrying Biden was extolling democracy, decrying dictators during his first remarks to the nation since his monumental decision to end both his reelection campaign and political career. The defense of democracy, which is at stake, is more important than any title, Biden said in remarks that were designed to have the gravitas of a presidential farewell speech. I draw strength and find joy in working for the American people, but this sacred task of perfecting our union is not about me. It's about you, your families, your future. It's about we, the people. With less than 6 months left in his presidency, Biden used the primetime address to defend his record, define his legacy, and describe his vision for the rest of his term. He repeatedly called on Americans to take up the mantle of safeguarding the nation's principles, asserting that as he prepares to exit public life, he was passing the baton to the public. Judy Patrick.
So it was a historic speech, delivered very well. I thought to myself at first, where's this guy been? He looked rested. He looked well. He looked clear-eyed, and the speech was full of the principles of democracy and service and leadership that had defined Joe Biden's legacy. But this speech was billed as he was going to explain to us why he was not going to run for re-election, and I didn't get that from it, and I was hoping for it.
Were you waiting for the line? Like, the line is, I'm leaving office, or I have suspended my campaign. Like, the definitive line.
Right. And I congratulate him. There was no bitterness, but there wasn't a sense of significant self-reflection on his part, I thought. And you know, to be honest, I really shouldn't have expected it. I mean, LBJ, when he left, when he made his announcement, he said he was doing it to devote his time to the, you know, to the presidency, to filling out his term. And he didn't really admit that it was because the polls were so terribly falling against him. You know, I can kind of understand it, if only they hadn't billed it as, I'm going to tell you why I'm doing this in this prime time address. That was missing for me.
All right, Kristen.
I think I'm probably like I
Teresa's
usually do.
Teresa's reloading.
No, exactly.
No, I talked too much. I wanted to create some space.
I think, like I usually do on this show, I sort of found myself in the middle, right? It's like I've always really liked Joe Biden. He has an extraordinary legacy. He had a very difficult needle to thread last night, right? My big question was, how many people actually watched it? And I think he realizes that less people are going to watch it than people that are going to watch clips of it or it's how it's going to be reported on. So he didn't have to think about, like, in my view, you know, sort of the what he was going to say in the actual speech. He had to sort of craft it based on how it was going to be received by the public and what were the seeds that he wanted to make sure were going to be reported on or the clips that were going to be shared. And in that way, I think he highlighted really important things that had to be done. And I agree that we saw signs of, quote unquote, the old Joe. I mean, he's such a nice man. He's the kind of person that we want to be leading this country in terms of the humility and the kindness and the authenticity and the, you know, for the benefit of others and having that philosophy, which is the polar opposite of the competition. So that I really appreciated. And you could also see that, yes, it's time for him to step down. I don't think any politician, yes, he agreed to level with us. And I saw there's a lot of, reporting this morning on, like, we didn't get that. But let's think about it from his perspective. What is he going to say? I'm stepping down because I know I'm going to lose. I'm stepping down because my health is declining. This was a no-win situation for him in terms of how direct he could be in this moment. And he still has 6 months where his expertise and his wisdom and his experience can really make a massive difference to this country, especially in foreign policy. So he really had to set the table for us to be reminded of the successes of his entire career, but particularly his 4 years, which are impressive. The first gun safety law, the climate change work he's been doing, the tons of things, right, that he reiterated that he's been doing. I really appreciated all the ways that he reiterated no violence, the right to choose, the right to vote, and reminding us that it is a choice about our future. This was an oval address to the American people. This was not a campaign speech. I personally think he rode the line well in terms of he couldn't, in my view, I'm sure readers will disagree, be more direct about his support for Kamala. He had to be speaking as the president of all people. And I personally think that he did the best that he could in a very difficult situation and showed us why he has had this long career, why he's been our president. And it was also clear to me, just by seeing the speech, why it was time to step down.
He that line toward the end where he is speaking about nowhere on earth could a kid with a stutter from Scranton, Pennsylvania become president of the United States. It was very much about the honor of the office, of his personal journey, if you will. And I thought that was very moving and a very fitting farewell. He's not leaving for till January, but a fitting farewell to the campaign and to his running as a candidate. And that seemed very proper. And I thought at times quite beautiful in the language that he used. Teresa.
Yeah, I thought it was a beautifully crafted speech. In fact, I went back and looked at the written version of it, and it really, he's exiting the way he entered. And remember that he was motivated to get in 2020 because of the tiki torches, right? And the people marching Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting, "The Jews shall not replace us," walking through, marching through Charlottesville carrying tiki torches. And I thought, how interesting, and he's leaving, passing the torch of a different type, right? And I thought there's some poetry there. But I thought that it was beautifully crafted, and that, in fact, he did. He was very explicit about why he was leaving, because he fundamentally believes in our democracy and the tenets of our democracy and our republic and our constitution, and he feels that that is at risk. With Donald Trump, the possibility of Donald Trump coming back into the presidency, though he never mentioned his name, and that he feels that the best way now, although he felt he could win, he felt the best thing to do at this moment in history is to pass that torch to the next generation to work to secure our democracy. And if you step back and take a pretty high view of a bigger perspective of this, the United States is not unique but quite different in the way we transfer power. And the peaceful transfer of power is fundamental to our democracy. And the fact that someone would give up that power in the way that he did is really a remarkable thing, that we're caught up in the fray and the frazzle of it right now. But if you step back and think about how amazing it is that a person who is really the most powerful person in the world was willing to give up that power for the sake of strengthening our democracy is a rather remarkable thing that happened. And I frankly thought that he did it in an eloquent way and told why. Why? Why is he doing it? Why is he leaving? Because he feels that our democracy is at risk, and he wants to, and it's not to be saved by any one person. It's the system that needs to be saved. And I thought it was also he gave all of us the charge. Who did he say is going to save it? He didn't say Kamala Harris is going to save it. He said, you, the people, need to save it. You, the people. That's our charge. Are we going to do it or not? It's up to us.
I really appreciate everything you just shared, and you really got me thinking about the greater metaphor of how, as a society, when we're thinking about what the country is going to be in the next chapter of this country, and how this is really a referendum between going back to the past and a system that did not have equitable representation of the people, or are we going into the future where there is going to be a more equitable representation of the people? That does come with the need for people who have power to step back. And we have witnessed how difficult that is to do. You know, it has taken him a while to come to this point. But when you look at this as a metaphor of the greater society's need to take a look at who has power and the struggle that they have in letting that go, he has once again modeled for us what the right thing is to do in order to move this country in the direction that it needs to go, in order to be the country that it was, the foundations that it was built upon and the hope and the promise of what this country could be. He has given us a model for that. And I'm curious if history will show that as a really powerful thing that he has done as a model for all the rest of us to understand what it looks like and how difficult it is to give up that power and make room for that, and where the expertise that he now has, how that can serve the next chapter.
David writes to us and says, Biden's selfless act for the preservation of our democracy and the voluntary relinquishing of power may very well lead to, and one hopes history will view, on par with that of George Washington. Anything you would like to add, Judy?
Well, I'm trying not to be negative, but
how's that working?
You can be negative. Negativity.
You know, Joe Biden is being commended for being selfless and giving up power, but my position would be it would have been truly selfless if he had given Kamala a better opportunity to build up her resume while she was vice president these last 3 years. I thought that she played too much of a secondary role, and she's having to pay for the price for that now. But also, if he had decided not to run, then the field would have opened up, and we would have seen if there were other Democratic candidates who would be interested in running. They were discouraged from running because, I mean, he is the incumbent. It looked like maybe he could do this, but it was clear for the last 9 months that the poll numbers were not moving, that we all thought, why can't anybody gain traction against Donald Trump because he has so many liabilities. But still, Biden insisted on staying in the race. And then it wasn't until the very last minute when he has Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries knocking at his door saying, we're going to lose everything unless you abandon ship. That's when he decided to stop. He was going to lose this election. Let's be clear. He's leaving. He's been a good president. He had a great speech.
Let me just read this letter from Bernie, and then I'll let you respond, Teresa.
Not Bernie Sanders.
Nope. Different one.
Okay.
The reason that... By the way, did anyone see him on TV last night? Of like, I'm going to work for her, and I believe in her, but I'm not going to endorse her.
Whining. He did it with Hillary, too.
Okay.
He did it with Hillary, too.
Anyway,
I can't take it.
The reason Biden is leaving is not because he felt it was time, but rather because he was forced out. You make it seem as though this was the plan all along, and he's doing this out of some noble purpose or cause. A few short weeks ago, he and the people around him doubled down on him staying in. Come on, says Bernie.
Thank you for writing. Good to hear from you. No, I'm serious.
I know you're serious.
You know, Joe's got a future on stage. Wasn't that a good reading?
That was a good time.
I like doing
that. He missed his calling.
I think
where's
that
Bronx accent?
It's all theater.
What gets me in trouble when I do that of reading the letters. But go ahead.
I think that, and this sort of weaves into the point that Judy was making, and let me just say, stepping back, I think a historic thing has happened in the last few days, and that's what I'd rather be talking about, the 38,000 people, I'll get to the answer in a minute, but 38,000 people in the last 3 days have registered to vote, 80%+ of them are young people. 40,000 people, women, black women, got on a phone call the other night, and then they probably another 90,000 because they were in groups. Another 40,000 black men got on a phone call. There's another one tonight with Indian Americans and Indo Pacific Americans
and white women
and
coming together.
White women
too.
Together, and they're $128 million raised in low dollar donations. So there's something happening in the country right now that's incredibly powerful that I didn't anticipate it, this groundswell. And I think that that's something we really, I don't want to lose sight of that because there's an incredible energy, which is what we've been looking for. And if you compare, there were three speeches last night. There was President Biden's from the White House, which I dare say was very presidential and one for the history books. There was Vice President Harris giving a speech about reminding us what's at stake, but looking to the future and where she wants to take us, but where we can all go together. And then there was Donald Trump, who is his main thesis was that people said, you know, I was going to change and I was going to be nice, but I don't want to be nice. Is that okay? And there were cheers about not being nice. And then he proceeded to talk about what he called Lion Harris. Well, I read that as not L-Y-I-N-G, which he spelled it out for us, but Lion, L-I-O-N. And I looked up in different cultures what is Lion, and it's a strong, stable, courageous person. So I'm going with, every time he says Lion, I'm going with L-I-O-N. He's saying that she's strong, stable. But in any case, I do think that we have to understand there's an incredible thing right now that almost never happens that has, I think, shocked the pundits, and we need to give some attention to that. But as for the timing of President Biden stepping out, I mean, anybody could have stepped in to the primaries in the last cycle. But if you have a person who's running, who's an incumbent, who has an extraordinary legislative record, you know, no one wanted to run against that record and against him. They had a choice. Just like, you know, there was some talk on the show earlier this week about how this transition has not been a competition, it's been a coronation. Well, anybody could have stepped in. Anybody still can until next week. The Rules Committee allowed it. But no one wants to go up against her record, right? There's no one who's stepping into the breach to against her record. And I think that President Biden stepped out when he, well, he said it last night. He basically was saying that he realized that the most important thing was to protect our democracy, and that he felt that he needed to pass the baton to do that.
I would investigate. No one wants to go up against her record or, you know, people. Yes, on paper, people can add their name into the race. I also think that there's an enormous amount of machinations and phone calls and meetings and various things happening behind the scenes that we might get glimpses about from different sources. But everyone is trying to coalesce around a united message. So I'm sure there are lots of conversations in different families from different candidates who, or potential candidates who are like, is it better for the future of our country and for what our party, for this greater vision of moving our party forward with this united front around democracy and making sure the country is represented by people who look like the country? Is it a more positive choice for me to throw my hat in the ring, or is it a more positive choice for me to, like, toe the party line and get behind the greater party? So I don't think people are saying, I want to throw my hat in the ring because I want to challenge her record. They're trying to figure out, they're also putting the country ahead of their personal choices and trying to work as a party to figure out the right choice. So I think the amount of political machinations going on just in the party behind the scenes, we're only seeing a tiny piece of it. We're only hearing about, from the different news sources, what they're choosing to put out or what some investigative reporters might be able to find out. There is an enormous, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg, right? There is an enormous amount of everything that's happening under the iceberg that the general public has no clue about. And what I feel that we're seeing is a party trying to unite and trying to be like, we have a short time, we want to take advantage of the swell, and we want to get people to November to make that checkbox next to our candidate. And leading up to this decision, as you mentioned during the break, a lot of stuff had to happen before he could make the official announcement to go. You know, we're going to talk about how impressive it was that Kamala Harris made 100 calls. Do we think they just created that list that morning? I mean, this has been in the works. So I think we all need to remind ourselves just how many strategies and conversations and all of that that's happening that we have no clue about.
Kristen Vangenhoven on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, July 25th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's show after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, July 26, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by Teresa Bourgeois, along with Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and President of Wesleyan University, Michael Roth.
I'd like to begin with the polling that is taking place in the election. This is the New York Times Siena poll, and this is one of the first, if not the first, a poll that has been taken after President Biden stepped aside a week ago tomorrow. It was taken after the announcement. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are locked in a tight race, separated by a single percentage point among likely voters. That is according to the New York Times Siena College poll. If the election were held today, who would you vote for You know, the candidates were Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And 47% of likely voters said Kamala Harris, 48% said Donald Trump. But if you look at registered voters, it's 46% for Harris, 48% for Trump. So you lose a percentage point for the Democrats if you look at registered voters as compared to likely voters. The margin of sampling error is 3.4%, which makes this a virtual dead heat. Jim Handler, I need help with numbers. What do I make of this?
So, you know, my fast answer, Joe, is, you know, there have been a lot of critiques of polling and things like that. I think this is certainly encouraging.
Have you been one of those people?
So
I'm not interrupting. I'm just
so one of the things we look at in really looking at the numbers is trends rather than the actual numbers. Right. At the moment, things are definitely trending in the right direction. But the other thing is there's kind of an axiom in polling that nothing settles for 2 weeks. So, you know, we're too close to these days to say much. The other interesting thing in this poll that didn't make sort of the top stories but made some of the other ones was that when they throw in Robert Kennedy, it becomes a dead heat. So he takes two away from Trump and one away from Harris. So, you know, the whole thing is still very, very open. The other thing is, unfortunately, in the American electoral system, depending exactly how you count, somewhere between five and seven states will make all the difference. And it's very specific counties in those states. And so far, there's been no significant polling in those particular places. So the places that are going to make the biggest impact on this election, we're just starting to get some of the feedback from. You know, the excitement among Democrats comes through. Some of the things that also are in this poll is, for example, 87% of the Democrats are now very happy that there is that Biden stepped aside, that we have a designated successor. Almost all of them were favorable to Kamala. So when you see the favorability numbers, right, by party, they look drastically different.
Yeah.
The other thing is if you add up the 48 and the 47, you'll notice you end up at 95. And that means there's 5% who still haven't made up their mind. And those are really the voters who are going to... So those voters in a small number of places are the ones who are really going to determine this election for a lot of us. And that hasn't even been polled yet. So the way fast answer is this poll shows a nice movement if you're a Democrat. This poll has to some degree canceled out the post-convention bump that always happens. So Trump had some post-convention bump. Not a lot, just because very few people who were Trump voters were changing their mind.
The Biden change.
But the Biden change had a lot. You know, again, it's just now propagating through.
And what's really interesting about that, I thought, in the poll was that there was so much agreement that it was a good decision.
Yeah.
So whether you were a Trump voter or a likely Democratic voter, there was extraordinary agreement across the country that Joe Biden did the right thing. And that's got to be bad news for Trump when there's extraordinary agreement that your opponent did the right thing in stepping down. That sets the framework for Kamala Harris to have much more success.
I want to hear from Teresa, but let me just ask this question or to any of you who want to answer it. But when we say that 5% of undecideds, that's an extraordinarily high number because we have always said in traditional, in the last several years of polls that there really were very few undecided voters. There were people that were very firm one way or the other.
I thought it was unregistered.
You know, it's a statistical number. So, you have to get into how the different polls are run and things like that to really get to these things. But the bottom line is that a small number of voters are going to make a difference. The votes in the previous election, 63,000 people changing their votes would have changed the outcome. I mean, that's a staggeringly small number, given the number of votes that were cast across the nation.
We will never know what is going to happen in November, but we do know that the last several elections have been extremely close. And I have no reason to believe that that won't be the case this time. Teresa.
Yeah, I hope I'm consistent on this and that I don't put a lot of stock in these polls until after Labor Day, and this one in particular, because I think that, as Jim noted, that the people who poll know that it takes some time for this to settle out, and I think that it's too early. But given that it takes some time to settle out, for those who do put stock in polls, this one would be a good one for the Harris folks, because even without that time to take into account what's happened over the last few days, there's a lot of good news in what I think is an unreliable poll. The polling that I've been trying to do is even less reliable, which is I've been really interested in talking to young people and just individually, and trying to talk to people that I don't know from different places around the country. People have had their young sons and daughters talk to me, and I talked to three people yesterday, and I've been thinking about that a lot because of what happened in those first few days after Vice President Harris announced 38,000 people registered to vote, and a vast majority of them were young people. And they could make a very significant difference in this election. And this election really matters to their future. I mean, every election matters to their future, but I think this one more than most. And what I've heard consistently is, consistently, including I talked to yesterday, this very interesting student who's from Connecticut, but right now is in Wisconsin, goes to in a school in Madison, and really is, like the other people I've talked to, not that tuned into the news, gets information from what I would consider non-traditional sources, although does see New York Times, but only scrolling, doesn't read the stories, so they doesn't really know a lot about both candidates, but even though doesn't focus on politics, doesn't know a lot about both candidates, has a deep feeling about it, where it's just not Trump. He's nasty, things that he says, doesn't know a lot about him, but doesn't want to go through that again because too much anger, too much hate. Knows very little about Kamala Harris, but is for her. And I think in the last few days, when I've talked to four different people, same thing, the sense of don't know a lot of details, want to learn more, but for her. And I think we really have to understand how people get their information. The other layered into something I read yesterday about this now race on to define who she is, and the Trump team putting $68 million in advertising in the next week or so to try to define her, as compared to right now there's $2.6 million in Democrat money for radio buys, advertising buys. And I think that's the real question of these folks who don't, they have a feeling, but they're not really sure. But who's going to define her and what that's going to mean? And how do you get these young people more engaged? The last thing I'll say is the thing that I've heard quite a bit about is they don't want to talk to other people about it because it ends up in an argument. They're just uncomfortable talking politics. And I think, how do we get young people registered, get them talking about politics in a way that's...
I just think it's important for us to remember that politics isn't a spectator sport. And the most important thing is not these snapshots, but to try to organize people so they go out and vote. And I've been very encouraged by the work that our All Britain Center for the Study of Public Life has been doing on getting newly eligible voters to go out and register. So we have a program called From the Diploma to the Ballot Box. And this is for high school kids who've just gotten their diplomas, who are 18, who are eligible to vote, who probably had no real inclination to register, but they are now registering. And then we make it very easy. We show them how to do that. In Connecticut, we can give this to universities and high schools and across the country, community colleges across the country, to register more people, to get more people not to read polls, but to go out and work on campaigns, whether it's for your school board or the local mayor or the national races. It's so important that we don't just talk about what we read in the paper or see on TikTok, but we go out and talk to people, other citizens, about the public issues that we face. And we do find that young people are ready to do that, especially now that they seem to have a real choice. A lot of them didn't think voting between two old men was a real choice. I think they were wrong about that. There was a real choice there, too. But right now, the energy, because of Kamala Harris's campaigning, because of the views she represents, because of her ability to connect with voters, I think is going to get a lot of young people to vote. And they can make an enormous difference, especially in these swing states.
So it's one thing right now we're seeing an uptick in a lot has been made about TikTok with the Harris campaign and young people. Not only TikTok, but the money that is being raised via TikTok is quite impressive. The people who have become engaged. But then there always seems to be, at least in our history, there's always been a gap between that excitement and people who actually go out and vote. So how do you bridge that gap?
That's called organizing, right? That's what we have to do. We have to train trainers to go out and organize folks to not just express their opinions through a pollster, but to get to the polls. And we all know that in many of these states, it's extremely difficult to cast your vote. You have to wait for hours. In Georgia, there's the famous no water online law, and there are many impediments to voters. But we've also seen in American history that people make enormous sacrifices, sometimes paying with their lives, for the right to vote. And I think what we have to remind young people and people of all ages that the right to vote is an extraordinarily important thing to hold on to. And we know it's being threatened by Trump and his allies, that they would discourage voting. What we have to do in response is encourage voting, whoever you're going to vote for, but to defend our ability to get to the polls and to cast votes for the people we believe should be our leaders.
On the campus of Wesleyan University, how difficult/easy is it for a student to vote?
Really, has been really easy. Because we had a polling place on campus for the last several years, and our voting numbers are very high. We belong to Campus Compact, which is a great organization all over the country getting young people to vote. We're also involved with the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, which has created a network of dozens, really now scores of university presidents around the country who have said three basic things: that participating in the electoral system is good for the individual student, it's good for the school, and it's good for the country. And if that's the case, then we should be getting our students to participate in politics, whether they are at a community college or a big state university or at a private university like Wesleyan.
And let me just throw in the addition that, you know, for a lot of our schools, so a state school, you know, pretty much the students are in that state. For a lot of the privates, for Wesleyan, RPI, others, right, one of the things that is really important to our students is making sure they understand they can get a mail-in ballot and that counts. And that's, in fact, I think, why a lot of states are trying to get rid of these mail-in ballots, because, you know, if I have to fly from my university, you know, back home
to vote,
vote and back. And by the way, most universities don't, you know, take 4 days off around election day and can't. You know, that's, I think, one of the reasons why mail-in voting and absentee voting becoming easier is so important.
Yeah.
Really changes the youth vote.
And we have these forms that show people how they can register either in the state where they're going to school or in their home state, encouraging young people not just to vote, but actually to get involved and participate in politics. Absolutely. And I think one of the things that Kamala Harris has done, so surprising in a way, is that there's a vibe that it's fun to actually engage in politics. Right. This brat campaign, that the dancing stuff, that actually being part of a political movement can be joyful, can be energizing, and it can make a difference.
Michael Roth on the Roundtable panel on Friday, July 26th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org or via podcast or in the WAMC app. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.